Okay, today is Thursday, August 30th, 2007. My name is Harriet Williamson. I am producer here at WILL AM Radio. World War II veteran Colonel John Lewis Frothingham is here in the WILL television studio of Campbell Hall on the University of Illinois campus in Urbana for the Veterans History Project at the Library of Congress. And for this interview, Henry Radcliffe is director of sound, lighting, and camera. Thank you so much for being here today.
Glad to be here, Harry. Right.
Could you tell us about your background and your education?
Certainly, be glad to. I was educated here. Let's start out. I was born in Boston, Massachusetts. I only have three words that are still Yankee words. Cocky and aunt and cunt are the three that I get talked about from time to time. We moved to Evanston, Illinois when I was about 10 or 11. I ended up graduating from Evanston Township High School in 1936 and came down to the university. My first interest in the military was probably hearing stories from my uncle, who was a pilot observer in World War I and was shot down in France, but did survive. He and my mother and I finally could see the handwriting on the wall. I'd come and I was in ROTC here. Wasn't very fond of it at all. I think I was taking it because I had to take it. But I did sign up for my junior year and got paid for a uniform and became even more disenchanted with what was going to be the Army life. So I resigned and paid back the $75 that they'd given me for my uniform. But as I say, then we could see that something was going to happen, and the war was already underway over in Europe, and had been for some time. My uncle and my mom heard about the candidates class in Quantico, Virginia, in the Marine Corps. And the candidates class was to be 3 months long. So we, or I should say they and I, signed up for it in December 1940. And I was called to active duty February 1941 and started a candidates class for 3 months, at the end of which, in May, I was commissioned as a second lieutenant and then went on to reserve officer's training and graduated from that after 3 months. And again, school was looming, so I went into the artillery branch of it, and I was in the artillery branch of it at the time we went to war because of Pearl Harbor. Stayed in Quantico for a while and then was transferred to the 1st Marine Division. 1st Marine Division was not fully formed at that time, so we're talking about probably the early spring of 1942. I was engaged at this particular time to Catherine, and Catherine also graduated from here. She graduated in 41. I graduated in 40. And so we did get married in March 1942. I was in New River, North Carolina at the time, which was really a camp out in tents, but the area was quite good for field artillery training. That went on for quite some time. And then when we realized that the Japanese, who had come down south from Japan a considerable distance, including the Philippines and many of the islands, including Saipan and Tinian and Guam, which they took away from us. And along about July, I guess, early July 42, we found that the Japanese were building an airfield on Guadalcanal, which is in the British Solomon Islands, oh, I guess 400 to 700 miles from the mainland of Australia. That, of course, threatened Australia with possible invasion and so on. Now, the Japanese never did actually invade it, but they did bomb Darwin and made some skirmishes along the northern coast of Australia itself. We mustered up, had a horrible rehearsal in the Fiji Islands. Everything went wrong so badly that the third wave of infantry, which is very early in an amphibious landing, we called off the whole rehearsal and just proceeded on to Guadalcanal. Now, the Japanese did not expect to see us until about the early spring of 1943, nor had we earlier expected to have to make an offensive operation against them until about the same time. So it was really a surprise on both sides. We were very fortunate coming in early that morning, August 7th, 1942, that there was cloud cover, a little bit of rain, and off and on. The Japanese totally did not expect us. They were still eating their breakfast when all of a sudden there was enough daylight that they could see this tremendous naval force parked outside the island itself. And we made the landing starting earlier on Tulagu and across the, we called it the Narrows or the Slot or whatever it was, across the way about an hour earlier over there, and 25 miles from them was the Red Beach where we landed about 11,000 Marines. In other words, just a portion of the 1st Marine Division, because that's all that had been ready to go at that time. Our landing was relatively unopposed. The landing over in Tulagi, they did have to fight all of about 2 days before they finally took it. My very best friend from back in near Boston, Massachusetts, was killed over there. And our only casualty was one knucklehead that took his rifle and fired up into the coconut trees and knocked down a coconut, and the coconut hit a Marine on the head and severely injured him. That was the only actual casualty we had that first day. We proceeded on, and after about 2 weeks, and we were lucky. I should also state that the Navy, because of a battle that took place, I think it was on the night of August 8th, 1942, and the Japanese had done some excellent training in night fighting. We were very poor and had done little or no training in night fighting, and they sunk four heavy cruisers, the Vincennes, the Astoria, the Quincy, and sunk the Australian heavy cruisers, Canberra, blew the bow off the Chicago, in other words, badly mauled us, right off Guadalcanal coast there. Of course, we didn't know any better. We were out there clapping our hands and cheering and everything else, thinking we're doing a tremendous job. Well, we were not. Well, that caused Admiral Fletcher to decide to pull his forces out of there, all of our protecting forces, and that left Admiral Turner with the who commanded the amphibious part of it, the choice of what to do, and he had to call off a lot of the landing of our supplies, our food, our 155 howitzer guns, which was the biggest we had. We couldn't land them. We couldn't land the engineer equipment, the pioneer equipment, in order to continue the building of the airfield, and a lot of other things that we wish we'd had. And so there we were. Fortunately for us, the Japanese, as I say, didn't expect us. They had only had a fighting force of about 400 to 500 people, and they had about 1,000 to 2,000 laborers. So they retreated. While they retreated so quickly, they left some of their breakfast on the tables there, and quite a lot of rice and fish heads. So we ate Japanese rice, which was excellent, by the way, and that's about all. We were down to one main meal a day and kind of a snack on what little we had, and the Navy did not show up again for a couple of weeks. Wow. With any more food, extra ammunition, and so on. As I say, the Japanese came over and bombed us. I think they brought sandwiches along from Rabaul and Truk, because they'd bomb us at about noontime, just as we were trying to get our own noon meal, what little we had going at that particular time. Finally, they did show up with some additional food and some cigarettes for the troops. I didn't smoke. I don't smoke. Suppose I smoked a pack of cigarettes my entire life. The second shipment of tobacco, they brought in some cigars and chewing tobacco, and I was a little happier with that. And along about the same time, the first of our airplanes showed up, which eventually became the Cactus Air Force. And the Cactus Air Force was simply a generic name of all of the forces, including some Australian forces and some planes that had flown off, carriers which we had lost that had gone down, but the planes flew in and joined our forces, Army P-40s and P-39s, which weren't much good for high-altitude stuff, but they helped support our ground forces and infantry who were still beating off the Japanese attacks. And this went on for periodically. Long about 2 weeks later, I think it was maybe August 21st or 22nd, Colonel Ijiki, who was quite a hero of the Japanese and had done an outstanding job in China where he had won all of his medals and so on. He only had half his force, about 900 to 1,000, and he decided to attack across the Tenaru River, which was just a little south of where the airfield was, which was very close to where we had come in 2 weeks earlier. I had run an artillery survey, and we knew and had registered on the mouth of the Tenaru River there, so we immediately opened fire on them, and I guess according to our infantry that we did a fabulous job. They penetrated our lines in a couple of places. Ijiki had said, oh, those Marines, they're young, they have inexperience, they won't give us any trouble, but we did give them some trouble. As I say, they got into our lines a couple of times, but we drove them out fairly quickly. And then again, there was a lull until about September. By now, the Japanese were getting to the point where they were far more serious about the fact that we were serious about continuing to hold the place, which we were, of course. And again, the whole big idea was to keep Australia from getting invaded. Later on, I'll get ahead of myself a little bit here. Catherine and I went to Australia in 1988, and we were down in Melbourne, and a lot of the people remembered that were old enough to remember the fact, and they say, you saved our you-know-what, and we were happy, and I can remember going around a corner, and we'd able to form a battalion to be in their Anzac parade. And as we'd come around the corner, they'd say, "Hi there, here come the bloody Yanks, you know." And so that was a lot of fun, and it was nice to be welcomed and appreciated and everything else that went on. Okay, we stayed there, and they made a big attempt to drive us off, and that's what Edson, Colonel Edson, and his Battle of Bloody Ridge. And we were kind of still hadn't received any reinforcements, although the 7th Marine Regiment, which was our regiment, finally was beginning to join us, and 164th Infantry Regiment. And the 164th arrived just the day that the Japanese were attacking Edson's Raider Battalion on Raiders Ridge. And we were able to infiltrate, with Colonel Hall's permission, the Army Lieutenant Colonel, his troops right in with our troops, which then reinforced our lines, and the Army was delighted. And from then on, again, they, 164th, started to call themselves the 164th Marines. They were a National Guard outfit and well-liked, I would say 4, 5, 6 years older than most of our Marines. And we enjoyed having them. Mm-hmm. Then again, a lull until about November, and some of the pictures that you have. My outfit by this time had crossed the Matanikau River, and because we'd made an attack against them, again to defend our perimeter, holding the airfield. And this particular time, we heard that the Japanese were with a huge task force, and 11 troop transports was on its way down from Rabaul and Truk. Now, by this time also, air reinforcements had come in, and our Cactus Air Force was much stronger, although the Japanese were still attacking almost every day with bombers and so on. But we could get aloft up high enough and out of the clouds and so on. Now, the Japanese Zero, which was the fighter plane, was superior to our fighter planes on a one-on-one basis. But when we coordinated our attacks and stayed up in the clouds and had the sun behind us and so on, and so we shot them down, about 3 of theirs down for every one that we lost. Fortunately, being fairly close to the island that we'd just flown from, almost all of the pilots we were able to rescue, although we did lose a fairly large number. I got a command at that particular time on my battery, across the Matanico, the only time in my artillery history that I ever received the command, fire at will, which means fire until we tell you to stop. That's the only time I ever had it. Well, what they were doing was telling me to get rid of, indirectly telling me to get rid of the ammunition that I had, and then they were going to pull me out. Of course, they didn't tell me all this at the time. So we fired until the tubes became hot. You could spit on them and on the tube, and it would sizzle. It was actually that hot. And they pulled us out. Well, on the way down, we sunk. Let's see, it was 7 of their 11 troop transports, and the 4 remaining, seeing what had happened to their fellow 7, beached them up north of us a little bit, and so we were able to damage them severely and so on. That was about the last major effort that they were able to make. We stayed on. Well, let me tell you a quick story there about the Cactus Air Force. General Geiger came in with his Major Cram, I think his name was his pilot. And General Geiger commanded the Cactus Air Force, which was everything that was there, whether it be Australian Army, Navy, or Marine. And they landed, and he took over the all of the air people that were there. And Cram went up to him and said, General, he said, can I borrow our plane? What for? He said, I've been talking to the Seabees, and those beached 4 transports up there are there, and they still got people that are unloading, and the Seabees have worked it out. Seabees would be construction battalions, mm-hmm. Navy, have worked it out so we can put a torpedo underneath each wing and then run a rope into the cabin, and we can go up there and we can drop the torpedoes on them. And I think the general's comment, the hell you say, yeah. And Cramp said, yes, but we think it'll work. And so they took off and they went up there, and darned if they didn't put one of the torpedoes in one of the transports up there and blew that side of it to smithereens. And then instead of coming home, he turns around and comes back and puts the other torpedo in the other side of the transport. Well, by this time, we're listening to the radio transmissions back on Guadalcanal itself. We were probably maybe 5-10 miles away. And I'm telling my troops now, they're coming back in. And for God's sake, don't shoot down our big, the general's private airplane. And so the troops said, nodded their head and said, yeah, yeah, yeah. And so sure enough, here they come. Well, the big old PBY, balum, 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 comes in. And it starts to make its landing. And it's being pursued and shot at by a Japanese Zero. And right behind the Japanese Zero is one of our Grummans, and it's shooting at the Zero. And behind the Grumman is another Zero shooting at that one. And so my troops obey my wishes and don't shoot down the big transport plane. Then they shoot down the Zero, and then they shoot down our Grumman. And the Grumman pilot later said, I wondered how I was going to land. I was damaged. He said, but you guys took care of that. Yeah. So we went on then, continued to defend, and they continued to bomb us, but they never made any big, major attack on us again on Guadalcanal. And I think it's General Patch from the Army came in, I think it was with his 25th Division and the Americal Division, and relieved us in the early weeks of December 1942. And then we boarded ship and set sail for Australia for rest and recuperation. By this time, 80% of us had malaria. I had malaria twice, and I went to the division hospital the second time, the second day that I got there, when my first sergeant came to visit me. I said, get me out of here. This is a real drag. So they dragged me back and had to put a guard on my tent because in my meanderings and so on temperature and all the rest, I'd start wandering. And he said, I'm going to put a guard on there because he says, you wander at night, and I don't want you to wander over to the Japanese lines, which they did. But eventually, I think I was almost the last of the original Marines on the island to get off the island. As I say, by this time, 80% of us had malaria. Mm-hmm. And the casualties there were not as great as we later suffered on Iwo Jima. I think we had 1,100 killed and about double that number wounded. which isn't too bad because we'd later been reinforced with some additional Marines. I think we were going to land in Brisbane, but lo and behold, they discovered a tremendous swamp just outside of Brisbane, full of Anopheles mosquitoes and so on. So they decided they'd take us to Melbourne. All three infantry divisions camped in and around Melbourne, close to better liberty facilities for the troops and so on. Mm-hmm. We went up to Ballarat, ourselves and the engineers, and I think an ordnance company, and my artillery regiment. As I say, by this time I'd made captain. We were getting promoted so fast I was only a first lieutenant, I think, for 6 weeks. Catherine was writing me. I'd married her in late March 1940-42, and she's writing captain, and I'm still writing her letters back signed lieutenant. Yeah. But we went up to Ballarat. Ballarat is the home of the only gold mine in Australia. And we stayed there long enough, and darned if I don't get transferred to Auckland, New Zealand, to command a 155 gun outfit, which is a much longer range artillery weapon, and I commanded it in a couple of maneuvers. And then back to Guadalcanal, of all places, back to Guadalcanal again. I participated briefly in the New Georgia campaign, got shot at a little bit, but nothing that really bothered me tremendously, which the bombings that we had on Guadalcanal. Not necessarily was I just terribly afraid to where I was afraid to move, because I kept on doing my job. Apprehensive, sure. But I, like most of the rest of us that survived, and I didn't get badly hit except a slight wound on Iwo Jima later on. But it was kind of those things where you figure, well, if you're going to get it, you're going to get it. But until you actually do get it, when it doesn't smart or hurt or anything else, and so you go on doing the particular job that you're assigned to do. Finally, they realized that they were going to need a lot of us to come back to the United States because the Marine Corps was going to build up to 6 divisions. Now, a Marine division at that time was, probably 20 to 22,000 people in an infantry division, which would include an artillery regiment and a tank battalion, some pioneers, engineers, and so on. So we were sent back to form one of the new divisions, and this, for me, was going to be the 5th Marine Division. And so in March, they said, go down to the airfield, and we'd build a second airfield and catch a transport plane back to the States, which I did. Of course, the plane came in and blew 2 tires on the way in and had a faulty engine, so they had to repair it. But at any rate, I got back to the States, I think it was March 1944. And you've got a picture of Catherine meeting me down in the Union Station with my overseas hat on and kissing and hugging and going through all of that routine. And we came up and had dinner in the Union Building. As I say, University Hall had been torn down by that time. And then very shortly thereafter, the 5th Marine Division got orders to go to Hawaii, and there we did some more training. And by this time, I'd made major, but there were so many brand new majors that they didn't have room for me in the artillery. So they said, you've had a lot of experience and so on. Would you like to go to the tank battalion? And I kind of said, well, what choice do I have? And they said, little or none. So I said, I'll go to the tank battalion. So I got up there, and they said, we don't know how we're going to use you. Can you fire the tanks in direct fire? And I said, a tank gun is a direct fire weapon. But yes, I can try. So sure enough, I tried, and much to the general's delight, the general in command of the 5th Marine Division, we put on a show for him. But we never did use them indirect fire in combat.
Can you explain what that is? I don't understand what that means.
Say again?
Indirect fire. What does that mean?
Well, indirect fire, if I'm going to fire at you, there's an intervening hill mass, and artillery can fire up and over and down on you. The tanks are just not geared for that. It's a high-velocity, high-speed weapon, and it, direct fire is the way it works.
Okay.
After all, they're a mechanized weapon, and they're going to fire at enemy tanks and so on. We had done a considerable amount of naval gunfire. I'd say that Iwo Jima is about 450 in, or from parts of Japan and maybe 700 miles from most of Japan. Naval gunfire had been peppering them all the way since the fall of 1944, it would have been. And then aerial bombardment also had taken place. Kuribashi was, I think, the Japanese lieutenant general in command. He had about 20,000 Japanese forces there. And they were there for over a year. And they dug in unbelievably. They had miles and miles and miles of underground tunnels. Iwo Jima is 5 miles long, 2.5 miles wide at the widest, and 1,000 yards wide at the narrow spit just before you get to Mount Suribachi, which is the commanding terrain and highest ground about 360 feet above ground in the southern part. And so that's where we're going to land, particularly our division, which was the 5th. And I went ashore with the infantry, the 5th wave of the infantry, which would be about 45 minutes behind the first wave. When I got ashore, I had a heck of a time going through this sloppy, volcanic, dark, almost black sand from previous eruptions of the volcano years before, which I knew were going to be trouble for our tanks. But our tank battalion commander had said, "John, you go ashore with the radio jeep, and when you figure it's time for our tanks to come in, give us a call." So I said, okay, I'd do it. I didn't have much choice after he said what he wanted, yeah. So I landed, and as I say, I saw far more dead Marines than I saw dead Japanese. And really, as I look back on it, I do not think well-dug-in troops are going to be that badly damaged. I don't care how good the naval gunfire is. I don't care how good the bombing is. If you were really dug in, because I'd been dug in right in the near the airstrip on Guadalcanal. And in fact, they dropped something like 25 to 40 different 500-pound bombs, and we got shelled by two battleships one night on Guadalcanal. And within a 25-yard radius, I had something like 20 odd holes, either 14-inch shell holes or 500-pound bomb holes. And I got picked up and slapped down in my foxhole, but I didn't lose a man. Yes, we did lose some Marines that night, but, you know, not really that many. Mm-hmm. So I think the same thing was true on Iwo Jima, that we didn't do that much damage to them. He had told his troops, "I do not want you to make any of those banzai attacks," which mean a banzai attacks, the officers draw out their swords and lead their troops to attack our forces. And they had been successful on some occasions on doing this. But he says, no, he says, the Americans have too much firepower. And only one dumb regimental commander, Japanese, was dumb enough to try it. And we slaughtered them when they did. But other than that, it was a nip-and-tuck outfit, or a fray, I should say. Some days we were lucky enough if we made 300 yards in the attack. Other days, maybe if we made 50, and some days we couldn't make any advance. The ground got more troublesome as we went further north, and there was a lot more rocks and hills and so on, not as high as Mount Suribachi, but nevertheless high. Mm-hmm. And the technique there finally that we developed with the infantry is that they would discover, well, they would get stopped. In other words, they'd get shot at and take some casualties, and then they'd call for us, and we'd come up with our tanks and our fighting tanks, which would fire a high-explosive shell, and we'd fire at shrubbery, anything that looked like it concealed a place where they were or where the infantry pointed out they'd receive some fire. And so we did this, And then we would back out the fighting tanks and run in the flame-throwing tanks. Now, the Marine Corps doesn't have any flame-throwing tanks anymore. They were considered a really an abusive type of weapon and cruel and so on. And I guess really they probably were. And so I think it was 1983, talking to some of my remaining tank battalion friends, they kind of outlawed it. And the last flame-throwing tanks we had was in about 1983. Hmm. And they were good. Flame napalm would squirt right out through the tube, which had another tube inside of it squirting out the napalm. And they could fire about 100 yards, and they can fire for 3 minutes. Hmm. And this we would blast everything that looked like it was a potential hole or cave or whatever it was. And it was effective. And bottled up some that were inside and burned up some others that were inside. Then we would back the flamethrower tanks out and run in the fighting tanks and shoot up whatever we could see with the infantry. And finally we would take the ground. As I say, sometimes we only made 50 yards. Other times if we made 300 or 400, that was really great. This kept going on. The casualties that we took were unbelievable. Unbelievable. It was the only battle that the United States, including the Army and so on, that that we were in during the entire World War II, where our casualties exceeded those of the enemy. Kiribati lost, I think, of his 20,000, he did lose. Of course, his were killed, all but about 200 or 300 that we captured, wounded and otherwise. But we lost 28,000 casualties in that same battle. I can remember we buried 8,000 of our Marines right there. Mm. And more died out on the hospital ships that we were able to evacuate them to. Along about the March, we were up in the far corner, and that was all that was left from the Japanese position. Turned out it was the headquarters of Kiribati. Kiribati committed suicide, or Harry, himself, and then they made a last counterattack and killed some of our army that had begun to come in to relieve us as we were unloading to get out of the place. So we threw our extra equipment that we'd put on the top of a couple of our tanks and threw it off to the side and finally wiped out the last of that 200 that had charged us. The colonel and I are on board an LSD, which is a landing ship dock, and that will take in the rear end. They bring in LCMs and LCSs and so on into the rear of this LSD, which is full of water, unload them, pump the water up a little bit more, pull the smaller ship back out and go get some more tanks. We had to leave about, I'd say, maybe 10 of our tanks badly damaged right there on the island, and started unloading. We're back up on the bridge, and I'm with the colonel up there, and he says, "My God, what is that?" And I said, "That's a Japanese light tank." He said, "What are we going to do with it?" I said, "The men want to get it fixed when we get back to Hawaii and see if they can make it run." He said, "You're kidding me." I said, "No, sir, I'm not." So that was all right. He just grunted and so on. So then later on, here comes something else, and he says, "Oh, my goodness, what's that?" I said, "Sir, that's a Japanese motorcycle." And I said, "That's for you." And he says, "Does it run?" And I said, "No, not now, but our men think that they can fix it too." So lo and behold, we got back to Hawaii, and no one, I was delighted because there was a message from Catherine saying Kathleen, our first child, had been born on April 4th, 1945. And very quickly we had the Japanese light tank running, and the troops were running it back and forth. And the colonel had his motorcycle, and he was delighted because he had his own transportation around the place and so on. Now, that's an overall description of my combat experiences. Yes, there were some other things that were exciting and so on. Now, I've taken up all the time and probably... I've answered some of your questions, but maybe not all of them.
Well, would you like to talk about your original training when you were at Quantico?
Yes.
And how was it? Because you said you had been disenchanted with the military, but yet you ended up going to officer training and and continued in the military?
Well, I didn't feel at the time that I got back out of the ROTC, I didn't feel that I enjoyed it. I wasn't enjoying it. Mm-hmm. Part of it was the fact that I had a real SOB as my commanding officer, mm-hmm. who was making it, I thought, as difficult as he could make it. Mm-hmm. I wasn't a whiz-bang at mathematics and so on. Believe it or not, I was in artillery, and later on I became a heck of a lot better at doing the same thing. But I just couldn't see the future in it, mm-hmm. for me. Mm-hmm. And so I got out. And then, as I said, I was smart enough and a major in history, and I could see what was happening overseas, mm-hmm. and I thought, this is really stupid now. Do you want to be an enlisted man, or do you want to... And when my uncle and my mom heard about the candidates class, mm-hmm. then's when I grabbed it. Quantico at that particular time... Well, we still had the 03 rifle, for example.
Now, what is that? What is that rifle?
Well, it fires a 30 caliber bullet, and it was an individual weapon carried by the infantry. We also had BARs, which was a far more automatic weapon that could fire rapid fire. But with the 03, you'd take the cartridge and you'd push it down, and five shells would go into the chamber. But then every time you fired one, you had to pull the bolt back and push it forward again. Mm-hmm. And later on, when the Army joined us on Guadalcanal, oh, we loved it when they said, look, if we have some casualties, you can have the M1, which was a much better rifle, now, and it could fire just as accurately.
Why would the Marines not have the same weaponry that the Army had?
Well, in many cases, Army ordnance and someone would develop it, and I think very rightfully they would give it to the Army to try out first. Mm-hmm. And the 164th, which I talked about, called them 164th Marines, showed up. They had them. But they were very gracious and would let us have some of them, mm-hmm. and we tried them out so on. The infantry, the training that I had in Quantico was all infantry-type training, all of it, mm-hmm. and how to employ your men and your squads and maneuver them and so on, and how to march through rough terrain with a 50-pound pack on your back and so on. Shoot, I'm lucky. Well, just recently recovering from surgery, I'm told not to lift more than 10 pounds for another 4 weeks here, yeah.
Now, is that training that you had in Quantico, is that the basic training that
yes.
the enlisted man would have?
Basic training, very uh-huh. much similar to the Paris recruit training at Paris Island
okay.
and San Diego.
Uh-huh.
Yes,
uh-huh.
very similar. And our instructors were enlisted people
uh-huh.
that later on, when we did get our commissions, they would salute us. And the tradition was to give him a dollar each time he got a salute, which was kind of nice. Yeah.
Now you had that type of training, and then you went on for two other types of training? Is that correct?
I went on, well, the officer's training, which was also at Quantico, the ROC, mm-hmm. Was even more the employment on up to a company level. So now a company level, we're talking about maybe 200 troops. And how to command a company in combat, in infantry again.
So what kinds of things would you learn then in that?
Well, you would learn how to tell your lieutenants what to do with their platoons and where to maneuver and where to go. And you guys take this hill over here and you guys go down mm-hmm. this ravine there and I'll see you at the other side over there and so on. And then we played those roles mm-hmm. as infantry people. Mm-hmm. Then the artillery training, as I said, which was the third group that took us up to Pearl Harbor time, was actually firing an artillery battery, indirect fire at targets at some distance away.
Mm-hmm.
So I was pretty well trained to do several different things, everything except tank battalion training, which took place several years later. Yeah.
So did you feel then when you were sent to Guadalcanal that you were adequately trained for what you were doing?
I felt that I was adequately trained. Combat experience, no, I hadn't had any.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
But as I said, I hadn't been shot at, but when I uh-huh. was finally shot at, it wasn't absolutely a terrible thing. I was apprehensive, but I was never scared to death.
Uh-huh.
Were there some that were? Yeah, sure.
Now, you were then a lieutenant when you were on Guadalcanal, and you were promoted?
I was a lieutenant until I found out about the second week there, getting letters from Catherine addressed to Captain Frothingham that, yes, I was a second lieutenant for 6 weeks, I think.
So did your role change then when you were on Guadalcanal with the increase in your
I was the survey officer for our particular battalion, running the survey to coordinate the fire to mass. By that I mean so that all four guns would hit the same target. You had to run a mathematical survey in order to do that. And I was the survey officer for the battalion, and that was my job as a first lieutenant. Very quickly, when I made captain, they made me executive officer of one of the firing batteries, meaning I was in charge of the four guns, or howitzers, I should say. Then I did that for 3 or 4 months, and then I became commanding officer of that same battery. And I was commanding officer of the battery when we left in about the 5th of, just after Eleanor Roosevelt, just before Eleanor Roosevelt called to make her visit to the division on Guadalcanal. Five days ahead of then, we left the island.
Oh, my goodness. Eleanor Roosevelt visited Guadalcanal?
Say again, please.
Eleanor Roosevelt visited Guadalcanal during
yes,
the fighting?
She did. She did. She's a gutsy lady.
I'll say.
Gutsy lady.
That is quite amazing.
Well, she did so many things for Franklin D. Because of his handicap with his paralysis and so on.
Yeah. What did the troops think of that, of her being there?
What did I think of it?
Well, what did the troops under your command think of
it? The troops loved it. Mm-hmm. The troops loved it, yeah. Now, Guadalcanal was still not secured when she landed there. Mm-hmm. The Army and one of our newer divisions, our Marine Corps divisions, actually kept on pushing. And I think we finally pushed the Japanese off the island in about February 43. No. Yes, February 43.
Can I go back to your howitzers? Can you talk about what they are and how would they be placed? Because you said you were in charge of four of them.
Yeah.
So would they be placed like a mile apart or 50 feet apart? Or how does that work?
At that particular time, we don't have any anymore. There was 75 pack howitzer, and they could be disassembled and they could be carried individually by men. Sometimes part of the parts after you disassemble it were heavy enough. It was better to have two men carry them. you could pull them with a jeep. They weren't that big. A 75, maybe 3-inch diameter of the tube would be the size of it. Then you'd take your four guns and you'd space them maybe 15, maybe 20 yards apart, or maybe even closer than this.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then you'd line them up, and then you'd get out there with your aiming circle, and mathematically, by swinging off angles, you would get them all so that their tubes were parallel. So that when you then fired the battery as a whole, all four shells hopefully would land on the same target.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And would they be fired at simultaneously, or would it be like 1, 2,
well,
3, 4?
If I was able to fire the battery all together, I would ask them to report to me when they were ready. And then they'd report, number 1 ready, sir, 2 ready, 4 ready, 3 ready. And then I would say, battery ready to fire. And then the fire direction center would tell me when to shoot. And when they'd say, fire when ready, then I'd give the command, fire. Well, also I had told them maybe fire 5 rounds, okay. Well, the first round would probably all go off pretty near together. But then on, they would fire when they were ready to fire, you know, when to realign after every fire, because it would jerk the gun a little bit out of the line that it had, so they'd have to come back looking through their sight to the aiming stake, and then they'd get back on and they'd fire until they'd expended the 5 rounds. And then I'd report back to the fire direction center, rounds completed.
Mm-hmm.
And except for that one time when I had fire at will.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the forward observers would take a look at where the shells were landing, and if they were okay, they might get 2 or 3 other battalions to aim in on the same target until whatever the job needed to be done had been accomplished.
Now, so how many men are involved in
a battery?
A battery.
Just I had park. Probably somewhere, when I was out there by myself, somewhere between 45 and 50 out there.
And would all of those men be involved at once in
No, there were many other things that they had to do. There would be communication people, there would be survey people, there would be my cooks, and however else was needed. Now, you should also remember that the Marine Corps does not have any medical personnel. The Navy furnishes us what we refer to as corpsmen, and the corpsmen go along with us. And each battalion, like my battalion, we had a doctor, Navy. And let's see, the Navy furnishes the chaplain, and of course the Navy furnishes a lot of the supplies that we need, too. Or they get the supplies and bring them to us,
So when you are in the process of firing these howitzers, then how many men would be required to fire each one of those?
They could probably do it with two, maybe three, but the usual complement in order to keep the ammunition coming up to the gun would be probably five or six.
And then how long does it take once the howitzer is fired then to for it to be ready to fire again?
Maybe they could fire three, maybe four. Once in a while, if they were really good, they could fire five rounds in a minute. But as I said earlier, on that time of fire at will, the tubes do start to get hot.
So there's a fire center that gives you the order to fire?
The forward observer calls for the fire and gives us the approximate direction. Now, he will fire and observe the rounds from one gun until he gets that gun's shells falling close to or on the target that he has picked. Once he has that, then he tells them, okay, right on. Then you can bring all four guns or the 12 guns from your battalion or guns from your battalion and other battalions as well.
So then surrounding you, would there be other battalions that are doing the same thing?
on Guadalcanal, let's see, we had one, two, three, four battalions. Four battalions. I said they never did land our 155 howitzers, but we had a 105 howitzer group, which was a little heavier than our 75 with us at the time.
And were those weapons very effective?
But along about October or November on Guadalcanal, for example, the Japanese had two, if not four, guns that could outrange what we had. So they could fire at us at will, and we could not answer the fire. Because the Navy had shoved off with our 155 howitzers.
Then, so Guadalcanal then, once it was taken, did it remain then in American hands, or did...
It became a forward supply depot. And so as we went on up to the Marshalls and Tarawa and Saipan and, let's see, Guam and Tinian and took them, and many of the supplies and food and so on would come that had been shipped from the States to Guadalcanal and Guadalcanal forward to these other places that we had taken.
How did the terrain of Guadalcanal compare to that of Iwo Jima?
Totally different. Guadalcanal was almost strictly jungle. Most of the fighting that we did defending that airfield was in a coconut grove that was palm trees and so on right along the coast. And it was fairly flat in some kind of grassy areas and very suitable for digging in and artillery placement and so on. Guadalcanal, except for a couple of level places where the Japanese had already built Airfield 1 and had almost finished Airfield Number 2, was flat, relatively flat only in those places. But once you got a little further north, it was very rugged, nasty terrain. Nasty as far as attacking the enemy is concerned. The enemy had so many places to dig in and hide behind rocks and boulders and dug in caves and so on. How am I doing?
You're doing great.
Okay.
Tell me when you're ready to take a break or
All
to
right.
stop.
Anytime that you're ready.
Okay. I understand that you saw the raising of the American flag on Mount Suribachi. Mm.
Anyone that said that they saw the raising of the American flag on Iwo Jima, and there were two flags, I'll tell you about them in a minute. I don't say that they're liars, but I say that they saw the flag, but I doubt seriously if they saw the actual raising. The actual raising took place in a matter of seconds. Mm-hmm. Let's see, Colonel Chambers, who commanded one of the battalions of the 28th Marine Regiment that assaulted Mount Suribachi, brought a small American flag with him in his pack. And that's the one that they took up there, and that first one went up about maybe mid-morning, maybe late mid-morning. And boy, when all the ships and the whole fleet out there and so on saw it, and so on, they started to toot their horns, and we looked around. I was, of course, had been ashore for 5 days then, and sure enough, there was a little tiny flag flying. And I must admit, it was emotional as far as I was concerned. Kind of tears came to my eyes and so on. Now, my Marines, on the other hand, their comments as they turned around was, "Oh, ye gods, there's our GD flag flying," and so on. They're not known for being the most articulate in the world about expressing themselves. Colorful, but not articulate. So Chambers, when he saw this and heard all of the horn tooting from the ships, said, "That's not big enough." So he sent a sergeant down to the beach to get a bigger flag. Sergeant gets down there to an LST. LST is a landing ship dock, lands heavy trucks and can land tanks as well. So he goes up to this one, the sergeant does, and the skipper is positively delighted. He says, "You mean if we give you one of our large flags, you'll fly it from the top of the mountain?" "Yeah, we'll replace the little one that's up there." "You're kidding me." "Oh, I'd be delighted," he said. So he gave the sergeant one. Rosenthal, who took the famous picture, is there, right there on the beach. And he heard what's going on. And he says, "Sergeant, what are you going to do?" He says, "I'm going to take this larger flag up to the top of the mountain. We're going to fly it up there." And Rosenthal says, "Can I go along with you?" And the sergeant says, "Sure, but you're going to get shot at." Rosenthal said, "I'll take my chances." Well, I forget the type of camera that he had, but at any rate, it had about 36 different shots in it. And the one that became famous was simply one of many that he took at the time. But he caught it just right. The flag is going up. All of them, five men, are straining to raise it even further. They'd found a big, long metal pole somehow, and they rigged it to hold the flag, and they got it up. And again, lots more cheering and more tooting of horns and so on. And again, I turned around and I saw it up. But I still contend the person who says that they saw it going up is probably not right. Mm-hmm. They saw it up, but not going up. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. Yes, I was there.
Do you feel that you were well supplied when you were on Iwo Jima?
Well, what?
Supplied in terms of your...
Oh, yes, the supplies were good by that point. Rather interestingly, Iwo Jima is still a semi-active volcano, and some of it's working underneath. And the infantry were able to put down their canned rations, dig a hole and put it down in there, and heat it, and then eat heated rations out of the can.
Is that true all around the island, or was it just in a few places?
Some of the other islands that we occupied were volcanic in nature, but that one was an active... Well, I can't say that it was an active volcano, but it was still smoldering underneath because that's where the heat was coming from, right.
Now, you were an officer during the entire war, so that makes you maybe have a different view of the war than the enlisted man, do you think?
A good point, Harriet. I hear stories about people who don't want to talk about their combat experiences. And when I am asked, "Why are you so free of talking about your experiences?" I was not in the front line infantry. I was not in direct, immediate contact with the enemy, swinging my sword or whipping out my pistol and so on. I only personally killed one enemy during the entire war. And it was really unfair because I saw where this one was up directing. He was a forward observer directing mortar fire on our troops. And I saw him because he was up on the top of the hill. And when he would drop down behind his cover, I could see the light shining through from behind him. And then when he'd come back up, the light would disappear. So I knew what was going on. Well, there was a 75-millimeter half-track right sitting right there, and they were receiving some of this fire. So I said, I know who's shooting at you. They said, Major, you do? Yeah. And I said, he's right up on the top of the hill. Can you bring us on him? I said, yeah. So I climbed up on the back and boresighted, meaning they opened up the breech, and I looked through the bore until I brought him down close. And then I said, okay, now fire one. They fired one. And I said, that's short. Bring it up 2 mils. Run it up 2 mils. Fire another one. That one went over. Then I said, all right, bring it down 1 mil and don't shoot until I tell you. Okay. When the little light at the top disappeared, I knew he was up in his hole again. And I said, now fire. Bluey. Up he went. His rifle went one area. His helmet went another area and so on. But as I say, that's the only one that I ever personally killed myself. And it was kind of an unfair thing. Me with a 75 gun and him with nothing, yeah. Oh, sure, I'm sure I was responsible indirectly for killing a lot of them with my artillery and later with my tanks, but I was not directly responsible for pulling the trigger, shall we say, yeah.
How were you in communication with the people above you who were even higher rank, and how would they let you know what the overall strategy was and keep you abreast?
The overall strategy that I'm quoting to you in some of the battles I'm talking about, I have researched it a great deal myself. That's why if I'm sounding knowledgeable, I'm far more knowledgeable than had I just stuck to minding my own business. But I enjoy talking. I enjoy giving speeches. And
so you're saying that during battle that you really perhaps didn't have an
heard a lot of rumors and so on. I would know, of course, if we'd advanced. And within a day or two after I was given that one command, fire at will, and then they pulled me out of there, then I found out within a day or two why they'd pulled us out, because they were afraid the Japanese were going to mount a big attack and wipe me out if if they hadn't pulled me out. Yeah.
But you wouldn't know, say, from minute to minute. And were you in radio contact?
Yes. Or? Radio and telephone, yeah.
What's the difference between radio and telephone in terms of?
Well, telephone is a landline. You actually have to lay the lines. And, of course, if you go over it with a tracked vehicle or a tank, you're going to chew up and break the line. Occasionally it would get caught in the wheels of even a Jeep and pull it apart. And the radios would work, but they wouldn't always work. But if you had land communication, it would work and work quite well. Yeah, really, really well.
Now, the men who were under your command, were they from all over the United States?
Let me think a minute. Yes, they were. Very few Marines from Illinois. Yeah. And I think I only know of one other senior officer from Illinois, and he's gone, yeah. As are most of the people that I served with, yeah.
As far as communication from back home, for example, your wife or your parents, was that something, a constant stream, or did that get interrupted, or?
Well, they had V-mail, and I'm not exactly sure how that worked, but it was a thing a form that you filled out, and you had to make it fairly brief. And it was far more rapid. Now, how it was actually transmitted to us overseas, I don't know. But I know I did get a lot of letters from Catherine, and I wrote a lot of letters. And yes, it would be spaced in between it. I think maybe there would be as long as 2 or 3 weeks before she'd get a letter from me. Not that I wasn't writing, because I was trying. When I could, I'd try and write every day.